Good morning. So, last time we started by talking about how we deal with updating the program counter. So that was our last piece of our pipeline processor. We centered the book strategies that they said, okay, well, we don't really have a program counter we compute right away. We're going to rename that to a predicted program counter. That's what our register is going to contain. And they decided that their strategy would that they would grab corrections to this prediction at the beginning of the fetch stage. So they take a little bit of time, have a mux before the instruction memory gets its address, and they would correct if we had a misprediction that we needed to fix up now that we know where that it actually goes to a different memory location, or that we had a value retrieved from return. That's what they deal with this at sort of the beginning of the fetch stage. I mentioned that if you're using this strategy, if you think of stalling, we need to be a little careful about that stalling, because we want to make sure that we take into account any corrections when we're doing stalling. So, you know, if we had a jump that was not taken, we want to make sure we take that into account when we repeat instructions, for example, because of a memory to execute dependency, where we need to stall just to wait a bit for a value to be available. Then we started talking about caching. So we mentioned this idea of a cache hierarchy. So we have some fast, small memories and some slow, large ones. And our goal is that we want most of the program's accesses to use these fast, small memories, but we want programs to be written in a way where they act as if they have a large amount of memory. They're using many, many megabytes of memory, but in practice, their accesses use these small, fast memories that are not many, many megabytes. And to do this, we have to be able to place the right things in a fast memory. And it seems like, in general, that probably shouldn't be possible. In general, it isn't possible, right? We're not going to be able to always do that. But it turns out that real programs are written in ways which are going to help us out with this. And there's sort of two big properties of real programs that we talked about that are going to make it possible for us to have it be the case that usually, when they do their accesses, we're going to have that stored in our small, fast memory. So one of these properties was what we call temporal locality. This is that if I see a value being accessed, it's going to be accessed again soon. Exactly that same value, same place in memory, going to be used again soon. And this is just something programs actually do. Another property was spatial locality, that if I see a value being accessed, there are values nearby it in memory, those are going to be accessed soon. And this is another sort of natural property of programs. So it's not the case that every program is going to have temporal and spatial locality. Like, you could definitely write programs where the temporal and spatial locality is very bad, but if we look at typical programs that you write, this kind of just happens naturally. That there are structures you write in programs like loops and arrays that just naturally have these properties, and our caches are going to take advantage of this. And if we think of temporal locality, well, that tells us if I see the program accessing something, I probably should have it in my small, fast memory because that's likely to be useful really soon. And spatial locality says if I see the program accessing something, I probably should grab the things around it in memory because those are probably going to be useful soon. So after talking about sort of our overall goals of caching and sort of the high level that will have multiple caches and memories, we talked about one particular cache design called a direct map cache. So to build this, we first said, I'm going to divide memory and cache into blocks, and the blocks are going to have a fixed size. Well, not just a fixed size, it's going to be a fixed size that's a power of two size. And this choice of a power of two means that I can figure out the location within a block by taking the least significant bits of the address. And that's going to be really convenient because, you know, if I had like a non-power of two size, I'd like need to divide and take the remainder, and dividing by like three or something would be actually pretty inconvenient. But if we can all just take the lower bits, that's really convenient. So that's why we're going to do that. And then once I've divided up my cache's data storage and my memory's data storage into blocks of the same size, I'm going to assign each block of memory to exactly one block of cache. And I'm going to do this in a simple way. We're going to say block 0 of memory goes to block 0 of cache, block 1 of memory goes to block 1 of cache. But of course, there's many more blocks of memory than blocks of cache because our cache is smaller and faster. So eventually I'm going to have block S in memory if I have S blocks of cache, and I can't put that to block S of cache because there's only S minus 0 to S minus 1, so I'm going to put it to block 0, block S plus 1 to block 1, and so on. And I'm just going to wrap around like that, and that's sort of going to be my assignment strategy. And it turns out, if I do this assignment strategy, that I can figure out what a block of memory is assigned to by taking the address of that block and looking at the bits just before, the next least significant bits before the offset bits, the bits that determine which byte in a block it is. And we'll call those the index bits. And this is going to be possible because I'm going to choose S, the number of blocks in the cache, to be a power of 2. So then we mentioned, so I have my cache block assigned to, my memory blocks assigned to one cache block, and I'm going to look things up in the cache. Well, I can look at my memory address, figure out what memory block it's a part of, figure out where that would go in the cache, but that's not actually enough because I can retrieve the data there, but I don't know if it comes from the right place of the multiple memory blocks that map to that cache block. So I needed two pieces of metadata to actually resolve this. So one thing I needed is that, when I'm starting out, my cache doesn't have anything stored in it. But I need some extra storage to actually know that, so we'll add a valid bit for each block saying, did I fill this up yet? Another thing we needed was we needed to know sort of where did the data in each block come from. And we could have just stored the address it came from, but it turns out that a lot of that address, we don't actually need. So for example, we don't need to know the offset bits because we know the block always starts at offset 0 and goes to the maximum possible number for the offset bit. So if I have 4 byte blocks, it always starts at offset 0 and goes to offset 3. So I don't need to store those bottom 2 bits in that case because, I know they start at 0. Also, if I know it goes to a particular row of the cache, I know what the index bits are. So I don't need to store those. So everything left over, we call the tag, and that's all we'll store. Yes, we could store more, but it's just redundant. We just keep the tag. Some questions about our direct map cache operation. So I'm going to go over a selected number of the quiz questions. So we'll start with quiz question 1. So quiz question 1, we were told we had this 7-stage processor, and we were told that the jumps execute 2 stage will use the condition codes updated by the previous jumps execute 2 stage to figure out the actual outcome of the jump. Also, we were told that in this case, this JLE here is going to be predicted as taken. So the prediction is going to be that we're going to execute those XORs. But the actual outcome is that it's not taken. So we end up going to this armor queue. So if we're running on our single cycle processor, what would happen is we first run this add queue, then this JLE, then this RM move queue. But that's not what happens in our, in this case, 7-stage processor. So instead, we end up with something like this, that we run fetch the add queue, we fetch the jump, and after the add queue runs its execute 2, according to the assumptions of the question, the jump can in one cycle use those condition codes it set to figure out the outcome of the jump. So the question basically told us that we didn't even need to use the whole execute 1 and execute 2 to do this, which is helpful because we've saved a cycle. And that's, I think, reasonable because even if it takes like 2 cycles to add or other ALU operations, it shouldn't take 2 cycles to like just look at 2 bits. Gotta AND and OR them together. And once we have that outcome, then we could fetch the RMOVEQ instruction. And while we were doing that, what would be happening? Well, we'd be running our XOR instructions. We'd in fact run 1, 2, 3, 4 of them. We'd start fetching 4 of them, which is that we didn't run them to completion, but we'd start fetching 4 of them before we figured out to run the RMOVEQ. and we counted this, and that means that cycle 7 is when we fetch the R move tables. Questions on that? Yes?
For this one, I think the slight conjecture is that we are forwarding the AdQ's result to the E1 stage of data. But the present description says that this, for the slip equal stage, that result won't be. Should be right at the beginning of the stage, and same goes for X. So I'm wondering that whether we should stall a stage in JLE.
So the question also states that the actual outcome of the jump is computed during the jump execute to stage. We use the condition code as updated by the previous execute to. So we're given an exception to that, just for how the conditional jump works, which I think is reasonable because what the conditional jump is doing in execute is way simpler than what add is doing in execute. But yes, maybe I probably should have. But yeah, been a little more explicit in the beginning of the question.
So would there be a hazard in the first execute because it starts to execute, even though it shouldn't be executed?
So question, would there be a hazard in the first XOR because it starts to execute?
Yeah.
So if we look at our diagram, so we never get to execute 2 in the first XOR. By that time, we've squashed the instruction. And so I would assume that nothing is stored that's going to matter. If it was, then we'd have to do, then the squashing would require work in addition to clearing pipeline registers. So for example, let's say it got to execute 2, then the XOR might pollute the condition codes. And a way we could resolve that is we could have a copy of the previous condition codes, and part of handling the misprediction would be storing those back in the condition codes. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So then, and quiz question 2. So quiz question 2 said we have a pipeline processor that has a different prediction scheme. And we looked at that prediction scheme. It said on a conditional jump, we had a bunch of cases. We could look at the prediction scheme and say, okay, so in the take in target less case, it would predict correctly. So that doesn't require any extra time. And in the not taken target more case, it would predict correctly. That would require extra time. In the other two cases, taken target more, not taken target less, they would require extra time. And the question told us, it was 2 extra cycles. The question also told us that when we had a memory to execute dependency, that required 1 extra cycle, just like our processor where we have a load to execute. And that returns required some extra cycles, but there were no returns. And it also said there were no other reasons why hazards would require extra cycles. So given this information, we said, okay, what would happen if there were no hazards? Well, in a pipeline processor, the whole point is that we fetch a new instruction every cycle. So it should be 1 cycle per instruction. That's sort of our baseline. And then we say, okay, well, we have to add these extra cycles here. So in our 10% of conditional jumps, 20% of them are taken target more, require 2 extra cycles. So 10% of the time times 20% of the time, that's when that happens. So 2% of the time we have that case, and that's 2 extra cycles. Similarly, in our conditional jumps, 10% of the time, 10% of them are this not taken target less case. So that's 10% times 10%, or 1% of the time, we need another 2 extra cycles. And for this memory to execute dependency, that happens 10% of the time, and we need 1 extra cycle. So that's how I sort of did my calculation, got 1.16 is sort of my average cycles per instruction. And here we're computing throughput, we're not computing latency, which makes sense because we're thinking about a big program. We don't care about sort of the instructions beginning to end time, we care about how fast we finish the whole program. We want sort of the average time that we observe running the program, which is going to be throughput. Questions here? Yes.
I guess I understand more now. You're talking about fetching on cycle per instruction, but the way it was written, it's a 5-stage pipeline. I assume it's 5 cycles per instruction, and that was shifting the answer by 4.
So, yeah, so I guess, so the question is that would, so I guess you were saying with five stages, don't the destructions take five cycles? So in terms of latency, yes. In terms of throughput, no. And the number we care about in this case is throughput. So if we're asking for latency, yes, the latency is a lot higher, but if you're asking how fast my processor is, you don't care about the latency for running a program. Does that answer your question? Right, you wouldn't say that because my processor has a higher latency that it runs your program slower. That work, okay. Other questions? And I guess the other thing is, if you think of what the question's asking, it's asking average cycles per instruction, and what I was thinking of there is sort of cycles divided by instructions. If we think of the program as a whole. Maybe I should have been a little more explicit with that, but I expected people to assume throughput because throughput is the value that I, as a programmer, would care about, not the latency. Other questions? Let's go, I'll talk briefly about question three on the quiz. So question three was asking about temporal locality for elements of A versus I in this code here. So the elements of A, basically we use them like twice, probably read and write, so like four times here, and then we go on to the next element. So we think of temporal locality, there is temporal locality. If I see an element of A being used, I'm gonna use that same thing again. I think where there was some confusion here is you said, oh, we have this whole array A, but the things that our cache is seeing is not the whole array, we're seeing individual parts of it that are being accessed. And those parts are what we care about the locality in. We're asking about the elements of A, sort of general, and if something's really big, you know, doesn't mean it had, like the temporal locality is, do we access the same thing again, not do we access different parts of something? Because the cache is going to have to act on those, you know, the addresses, not on sort of the range of things. So if we think of each element, you know, each address the cache is getting, is it going to be accessed again? Yes, but compared to I, well, I is going to be accessed tens of thousands of times in this code, in quick succession. And another way of thinking about it is that if I wasn't kept in a cache or in a register, you would be really, really disappointed. If an element of A wasn't, you'd be disappointed, but not nearly as much. But it'd be really annoying if we have to go I. With the elements of A, well, we're kind of going to have to go to something slower storage for them, you know, every once in a while because there's so many of them. But for I, that shouldn't be necessary, given how frequently we're accessing it. That it should be possible to keep that exact thing. You know, there's one thing to keep in there. With A, there's so many things, you know, and our accesses are spread across all of them. So there's less opportunity for temporal locality. So the temporal locality for I is just a lot better than each element of A. And I think the confusion was that, yes, we're accessing the array A about as much as I, but the array is not what we keep in cache. We keep elements of the array, single things we access with like one instruction. There's no one instruction that reads the whole array. So questions about, okay, yes. So this question for spatial locality of I, we're talking about the machine code. So when we talk about the temporal locality of A and I mean the data. So I'll be, yes, the machine code has spatial and temporal locality, but we'll mention we're talking about instructions, right? and I and A aren't instructions. So I agree that that as far as the instruction locality, so there is a lot of locality there. I wouldn't like separate A and I because they're probably like they're in the same instruction. It, the thing that we're accessing is that instruction, not like parts of that instruction. Does that answer your question? Other questions? I think that's all on the quiz then. Any other quiz-related questions? I do not intend to go over 4, 5, and 6 unless I have questions on that. Yes?
So I could go over 6.
Sure, 6, okay. So in question 6, we were given a cache. We were told, well, we weren't told explicitly it had 4 bytes per block, but we could see that we had a list of bytes, and there were 4 of them in each block. So it had 4 bytes per block, which means we had 2 offset bits because we needed... We think of numbering the 4 bytes, we need to number them 00, 01, 10, and 11. So we need 2 bits to do that. And we could tell we had 4 sets, 4 rows, and therefore 2 index bits. By the same logic, also, they were numbered with 2 bits. And if we remember how our addresses split up, we take all our addresses and divide them up into 2 index offset bits, 2 index bits, and then the tag, starting from the least significant part. So I can look at the addresses we had for that and say, okay, we had our address for the first was 7, so the least significant 2 bits are those bottom 1, 1, that's the offset. The next 2 bits are our index, and I didn't write all the leading zeros, but we need 2 bits, so there's going to be a 0 there. And then everything else is 0, so our tag is all 0. So I get tag of all 0s, index of 0, 1, offset of 1, 1. Figure out this in my cache, I say, okay. So index of 0, 1, it's valid, so I check the tag matches. 1, 1, 0 does not match our tag of 0, 0, 0 we got from the end. And I repeat this process for all my addresses. So for example, if we go to like the third address here, my offset is this 10, my index is this 00 before it, and my tag is 010. I didn't write all the loop zeros, but 010. So I compare index 0, I check if the tag 010 matches 000, 001 rather. If it does not, so it's a miss. Yeah. Some questions, follow-ups? Other quiz-related questions? Okay. So let's do go through sort of the operation of a direct map cache. So here I have a direct map cache, and I want to figure out what happens when I access this list of addresses, which I'm going to be in binary and hexadecimal. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to figure out how do these addresses get split up into tag, index, and offset. And I'm told here that I have 2-byte blocks, which means I need 1 bit to determine which of the 2 bytes it is. So I need to know whether it's even or odd, know which part of the block it is. And I have 4 sets, which means I need 2 index bits, which I can also see based on the numbering I have for the rows here. So I can also figure that out with the formulas we saw last time. And I'll find out I divide up each of these addresses. So the least significant bit is my offset bit. The next 2 least significant bits are the index. Everything left over is the tag. So then I can simulate what happens here. So I have my first access to address 0. I look at the index. It's 0. I check row index 0. It's not valid. There's nothing there. It must be a miss. And when I have a miss, I'm going to assume temporal locality. That's going to be accessed again soon. So I'm going to bring in that byte and I'm going to have to bring in the whole block to do that. So I'm going to bring in set that is valid. I'm going to copy the tag over, and I'm going to bring in the contents of memory that include that. So not only address 0, but also address 1, because that's the rest of the block. How do I know it's the rest of the block? Because the block is, we have our same tag index. So the tag we know is all zeros. The index is 0, 0 from this row, and our possible offsets are 0 and 1. So that's the block. So it's 0 to 1 based on that, based on the tag and index matching. So then I access address 1. So I'm going to check index 0, because there's index 0 in this address. I'm going to check that if the tag matches 0, 0, 0, does it match 0, 0, 0, 0? It does. So this is going to be a hit. I'm going to retrieve the data. So you could look at it and say, oh, you wrote it comes from memory at 1. But the processor is not going to check that. It's going to check the row. Going to compare the tag and the element. So then we have an access to 6.3. So this is index 1. It's invalid, so it must be a miss. And we're going to bring in the block containing address 6.3. And in this case, our tag is going to be 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. Our index is 0, 1, and our possible offsets are 0 and 1, which means that we end up with 6.2 and 6.3 as the memory addresses that the values we store come from. So remember, we decided the blocks when we divided up memory. And that's what the blocks are. We don't get to change where the block starts. You've kind of fixed that. So even though here you might say, gosh, we're accessing address 6.3, and I think that means 6.4 is much more likely to be accessed than 6.2. I agree with you, but the way our cache is designed, we can't take advantage of that because we don't have any place to store that, oh, I'm storing this block starting at 6.3 instead of 6.2. That's not possible. And 6.4 has a different index. If we ask for 6.4, we're going to be looking in row 3, not row 2. So, you know, we have to store 6.2 and 6.3. That's the way we've divided up the memory. So that's what's going to be ended up being stored there. So then we access 6.1. So 6.1 has index 0. I look at index 0. It's valid. Not done. I need to check the tag. So the tag is all zeros. I compare that to 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, and it doesn't match. So that's going to be a miss. But because it's a miss, I'm going to bring in address 6.1. I'm assuming temporal locality, so therefore I need to bring in address 6.1 so we can have it be a hit again later. Now in this case, temporal locality is not a mistake. It is not correct assumption because I access 0 again, which I've just gotten rid of. But we're assuming temporal locality, even though, yes, it's not always going to be correct. So we're going to replace that with 6.0 and 6.1. And in this case, 6.0 and 6.1, because we're just looking at, again, our tag, in this case, is 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. Index 0, 0, and offset 0 and offset 1. That gives us the range 6.0 and 6.1 is what we want to bring in for the block. So questions about what I've done so far in simulating how the direct map cache works? Okay, so then we have an access to 6.2. This happens to be a hit, so we say index 1, look at index 1, it's valid, check the tag 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, yep, it matches, so it's going to be a hit. Then I access 0, 0. Now, we accessed that before, but we mentioned that when I access 6.1, I got rid of it. So it's going to be a miss. And when that happens, we're going to replace 6.1 with 0 again. We're going to say, we still assume temporal locality. So, well, I accessed 0 more recently than 6.1, 6.0. So we're going to bring in 0. Because I assume I'm more likely to access it soon based on temporal locality. So you get to replace block zero from having 6-0 and 6-1 to having 0 and again. Then I access address 6-4. So this says index 1-0. I look at 1-0. It's invalid. It's a miss. So I'm going to bring in address the block with 6-4, which is 6-4 and 6-5. So questions on how I simulated this cache? OK, so let's do a different example. So here, I have the same addresses, but our cache now has 4-byte blocks. So what does that mean about how we split up the addresses? What has changed? Yeah. The offset is 2 bits. And our offset is always the least significant bit, so this is our offset. How about our index? What's our index now? The index bits. So this here is our offset. What's the index? Yeah. The next 2 bits, next least significant 2 bits. Yeah. So how do we get us 2 bits? So one way is we could say, oh, well, that's 2 bits. Another way we could say is there's 4 rows still, 2 to the 2 is 4. 4 bits, and everything left over is going to be our tag. Okay, so that's splitting up the address. So we could do that, also do this with the formulas we saw earlier, which is just another way of doing that reasoning, and we get our split up of tag, index, and offset. Questions about splitting into tag, index, offsets in this case? Okay, so let's now we have done that, let's figure out which accesses now are hits or misses. And assume, I didn't write it out explicitly, let's assume that everything starts out as invalid. So all the valid bits are 0. Perfect. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start first one. So who thinks our first access is a hit, is a miss? So this is probably the simplest one. It's definitely not in our cache because there's nothing in the cache. So we need to figure out what happens as a result of this. So we're always going to bring a value in if it's a miss. So where does this go? Well, we look at our index. Our index is 0, 0. So that's going to be in this first row of the cache. So this is going to become valid. We need to copy our tag, which is all zeros. And we need to figure out what the block is that we bring in. So to figure out what the block is, well, you know it's going to be everything with the same tag and index. So our tag is all zeros. Index is all zeros, and our possible offsets go from 0, 0 all the way to 1, 1. So this is going to be values from memory at address 0 through address 3. So questions on how I figured out what goes in their cache after this access? Okay, our second access, we think it's going to be a hit. Be a miss. Okay, so we have a hit, and maybe the simplest way for us as humans to tell this to look at, oh, I wrote down 0 through 3, it's in that range. That's not what the processor is going to do. The cache is going to actually take go to row 0. It's going to check the valid bit. It's valid. It's going to check our tag. It's all zeros. Does that match the tag and the address? Yes. So that's going to be a hit. How about our next access? We think it's going to be a hit, a miss, a miss. And the way our cache is going to detect that is it's going to look at set 0. It's going to say, OK, index 0, it's valid. But the tag, is this all zeros? 0, 0, 0, 0? Nope, not all zeros. Doesn't match the address. Therefore, it's a miss. And what we're going to do as a result of that is that we're going to say, OK, well, I better bring in the rest of this block. So we're going to update our tag to match the thing we just accessed, and we're going to read in from this block. And this block starts at an at offset with all zeros. So our tag is 0, 1, 1, 0, our index is 0, 0 again, and our offset ranges from 0, 0 to 1, 1. So that's going to be from, this is going to be 6 to 6, 0 through 6, 3. Index. Questions on how I got that range? So notice that because our blocks don't start at offset 0, you know, just because I wrote in 6, 3 doesn't mean that I read in 6, 3 through 6, 4, 6, 5. Nope. I've divided things up into blocks in advance. When I access something near the end of the block, I get the block from the beginning. Doesn't matter that I access from near the end. And it wouldn't matter if it were, you know, the case that later on I wasn't accessing the rest of this block. Sorry, I'm just getting the whole block. Okay, so how about our next access? Who thinks we have a hit? A miss? Okay. Most consensus for a hit. So this is matches the tag and index we just put in. How about our next access? Hit? Miss? So this is indeed a hit. Still matches the tag index. How about our next access? Who thinks we have a hit? A miss? So we have a miss. And how is the cache going to tell it's a miss? Well, the cache is going to check the index. So index 0 again. It's going to check the tag. Well, the tag, because of what we just did, doesn't match all zeros anymore. Used to, doesn't anymore. And what we're going to do as a result of this is we're going to undo what we just did and go back to the original configuration of having all zeros in here and having 0 through 3, because we're bringing in that whole block, replacing the things we just accessed. Because our assumption is, well, we accessed 0 more recently than 6, 2. Therefore, the block with 0 in it, address 0 in it, is more important than the block with address 6, 2 in it. That may or may not be the case, but that's the assumption we're going to make in this cache design. Then we have our access 264, which is going to be a miss. And what we're going to do is, well, this is index 1, so it's going to go in index 1. And we're going to bring in this whole block, which happens to be 0x64 through 0x67, when I do the same, what's the possible range of offsets calculation. So questions on how I figure any part of this out? We have our operation of this direct map cache. And in these examples, we've seen something that's maybe kind of annoying, that we have some coincidences where we have two addresses which look like they're kind of unrelated. So like 00 and 60, like they're far apart. They're probably not unrelated things, but just by coincidence, they have the same index. And this is actually a thing which happens in practice, that sometimes we'll have two different things that happen to have the same index by accident. And it's really unfortunate for these direct map caches because we end up sort of having these things conflict with each other. In fact, this is called sort of a conflictness. So here, right, I really wanted to keep 0 and 6, 1 in the cache together. You know, I wanted to be able to do that. And just because the indexes happen to match, I didn't do that, even though I actually had extra space in my cache. There's an extra block there I never used. But just because of the assignment and some coincidences with how the indexes worked out, I ended up not being able to do that. And this is enough of a problem in practice that often will go to something a little more complicated than a direct map cache. So we're going to extend the direct map cache idea to add some alternatives for each index. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying, I'm going to still have 4 blocks in my cache, but rather than organizing them into 4 rows, I'm going to organize them into 2 rows. Or another way of looking at this is I'm going to like kind of staple 2 small direct map caches together to make a bigger cache. And the purpose of this is now, when I have 2 things that happen to have the same index, I have another place to put it so I can store both of them rather than getting rid of one to put the other in. And hopefully this means when I have sort of those coincidences, I'm less likely to have problems where I get rid of things that actually are being accessed soon. And this idea is called associativity. So this is called a two-way set associative cache. So our sets, as before, are our rows. So we have 2 rows, so 2 sets. In this case, each set contains 2 blocks. We call the columns ways, so hence two-way. And as far as figuring out how we divide up addresses, this is very similar to what we did in our direct map cache. The only difference is we have some extra blocks per set. But if we can figure out the number of sets, that's the number of rows, that's going to tell us the number of set index bits. So in this case, I have 2 sets, 2 to the 1, so 1 index bit. But I could also see that because I remember the rows 0 and 1, which needed 1 bit. I have 2 byte blocks, so as before, that's 2 to the 1, so I'm going to need 1 offset bit. And everything left over is going to be a 10. So if we think about our access pattern from before, so I'm going to divide up my addresses, 1 offset bit, 1 index bit, and I have now a bunch more tag bits. And the simulation is very similar to before. So here, I have index 0, so I look in this first row, and it's a miss, so I'm going to put it somewhere in there. So in this case, I'm really in the block with 0 and 1, and that means that when I access 1, I had spatial locality. I was assuming spatial locality by having 2 byte blocks, but that assumption worked out for me, so I have a hit. Then I access address 63. This has index of 1, so I'm going to look in the second row. They're both invalid, so that's going to be a miss. I'm going to bring it in somewhere. I'm going to access 6-1. And this is a case we're going to finally do something different than our direct map cache. I'm going to say, okay, so 6-1, when it look at index 0, I'm going to check, is it here? Well, this is valid, but the tag doesn't match, so no. Is it here? This is invalid, so no. So it's a miss. I'm going to bring it in, and I'm going to say, well, I have a space I can put it where I don't have to get rid of something that could be useful. So I'm going to put it there. So I'm going to bring in 6-0 and 6-1. And now I have them both stored. That's the advantage of this design. The disadvantage is, well, now I'm checking more things every time I have an access because I have to check both columns. And I could do this with more than two columns, which I have to check three or four possible ways. So then I have access to 6-2. So I look up index 1, check each possibility. So the first one is valid. Does the tag match? Yes, it does. So it's there. That's going to be a hint. Then I have access to address 0. So I look at index 0. First, I check the first way. Is it valid? Yes. Does the tag match? Yes, it does. So that's a hint. And then I have an access to 6-4. So what do I do here? So I look at index 0. I check the first way. Is it valid? Yes. So I compare the tags. All zeros. Does it match 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1? So that's not matching. Check the next one. It's valid. So I'm going to compare the tags. 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 0. Does that match 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1? No, it doesn't. The 1 differs. So it's not either of them. So that's a miss. And a problem we'll talk about next time is now I need to put 6-4 in somewhere in the set 0, right? Because we still are assuming that I'm likely to access 6-4 soon more than anything else. So I want to put it somewhere in the cache, and it has to go in the first row because it is index 0. But I need to figure out which of those two values I replace, and there's actually multiple choices processors make for this. We'll talk about them probably next time. So questions on our associative cache. So basically, so one way of looking at it is we basically duplicated our direct map cache and we're using two of them at once. Or we've just kind of, because we have, now we have sort of more than one choice per column. And here I'm showing two ways just because that fits on the slide, but we can actually do this with 3 or 4 or 5 or a lot more. Yes? Question, if I do the associative cache, do I have the index be 1-bit? No. So I just do that for space on my slide. But we can have as many rows as we want as long as it's a power of 2. So we could have 1 row, we could have like 1,024 rows, and that's all real cache might see. Other questions? Yeah. Question, how do we know it's going to be more efficient? It's not necessarily. Not guaranteed. And you could construct list of addresses where adding associativity but keeping the cache size the same will increase the number of misses. That's not true for typical programs, and not true in the sense that people have like run typical programs in a way where they recorded every address they accessed and basically simulated this on a whole bunch of caches. And when they do that, they generally find that adding associativity and keeping the size the same, like we did in this example, usually decreases the miss rate up to like 16 or 32 ways. Usually decreases it noticeably, I should say, up to like 16 or 32 ways, yeah. What's a common number? We'll have some examples later. It usually depends on where in the cache hierarchy it is. So, other questions? Okay, so we have our associative cache. So if we think of this at sort of the operation point of view, we're gonna have our index. We're gonna use our index to retrieve a row of our cache. In this case, a row is gonna be multiple blocks that we're gonna get. And sort of the part where we use immolent caches actually has a way of taking the row number and giving us the values in that row. And we're going to check our valid and tag bits. We're going to check it for each of the blocks. And at most, one of them is going to match. Not more than one, and possibly zero. So if any of the match is going to be a hit, and we're going to use which one of the matches. So in this case, I'm using a box because it's either match, the first row column either matches or it doesn't. If we have three or four ways, we're going to do something more complicated. But using the sort of tag comparisons, we figure out which one, which block is actually the one we want, and we select that, and the rest is as if we had a direct map cache. So questions about our cache lookup, sort of from what the hardware looks like. So in our lookup, we have sort of three cases. So one case is that we can look up a row, and we could just be starting up, and none of the blocks are valid, in which case that's going to be a miss. Probably a common case for a miss, though, is that the blocks are valid, but it turns out that none of the tags match. That's going to be something which is going to be the most frequent type of miss we have. And we can have hits, in which case exactly one of the blocks will match the tag. Probably most of them will be valid, but exactly one will match the tag. Okay, so I talked about our associative caches, so there's some terminology. So we can think of our direct map caches as kind of a degenerate case of an associative cache. So I said we had a two-way set associative cache, that was the one we showed you, we had two ways. We can have any number of ways we want, doesn't even have to be power of two, and we'll call that an E-way set associative cache if they're E-ways. And we can think of our direct map cache as a one-way set associative cache. So it's just a special case of this general idea of a cache design. There's a special case at the other extreme called a fully associative cache. So we can put everything in one set. So if we have one set, how many set index bits do we have? Any volunteers? One set, how many set index bits? People are putting up zero, which, right, okay. So we have zero, which means one set, which means zero set index bits. Which means our address is divided up into tag and offset. And we compare the tag and the address to every single block in a fully associative cache. So there's only one set. We don't actually, every block can go everywhere, which is sort of the opposite of our direct map, where every block of memory can go to exactly one place. With the fully associative, every block of memory can go to anywhere in the cache. And our E-way set associative is kind of just a point in between. And most of the caches in our processor are somewhere in this in between on modern processors. We do see some actual examples of caches that are direct map or fully associative, but usually they're one of the in between types. And as for figuring out tag indexes, also I mentioned formulas are very much the same. So here is the formulas updated for associativity. What changed? Well, our cache size changed. Remember, cache size is the size of data. So now we have to take into account, not only do we have a certain number of rows, those rows have more than one block in them. We need to take into account the number of blocks in a row, which is our E. But the rest is actually the same. So the number of sets is related to the number of set index bits, because we take 2 to the number of set index bits, that should be the number of sets. Similarly for block size and the number of block offset bits. And the tag basis, as before, just the bits left over. And you can do this from the formulas. I prefer to do it from thinking about how it relates to drawing out the cache rather than trying to memorize these formulas, so I don't make mistakes memorizing these formulas or using them in your cases. Okay, so as for typical cache size, so my desktop has, this is the data cache and the L2 and L3 cache, which are shared between data and instructions. So the data cache on my desktop is 32 kilobytes, and this is the cache size, which is the data size. And when I'm writing kilobytes here, I mean a power of 2. So this is 32 times 2 to the 10 bytes. And similarly, our L2 is 256 times 2 to the 10, and our L3 3 is 8 times 2 to the 20 for megabytes. So that's the sort of total data size. The L1 data cache has 8 blocks per set. So it's an 8-way set associative cache with 64 byte blocks. The L2, 256 kilobytes, it's a 4-way set associative cache, again with 64 byte blocks. And the L3 on my desktop is an 8 megabyte cache, so 8 megabytes of data with 16 ways and 64 byte blocks. And these are sort of, this sort of level of associativity is pretty normal. We might see later in the semester why they chose to make the L1 more associative, which has to do with other parts of the memory system called, we'll talk about when we talk about virtual memory. But this is sort of typical parameters. And the exercise here is, I have an address 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Let's divide that up into tag, index, and offset for each of these caches here, the L1, L2, and L3. Okay, who'd like some more time? Who can give me a first step? What's a good first step for these problems? Yeah.
Convert the hexadecimal to binary to figure out.
Okay, converting the hexadecimal to binary. Yes, you can do that. I've reserved that here. Okay, so another good early step. Yeah.
Look at the offset bits.
So figure out the offset bits. How are we going to do that? Okay, you say, okay, the block size tells us the offset bits because we want to look on a block and know where in a block we are, those are the offset bits. And we have six of them because of 64 blocks. 64 is 2 to the 6 bytes. And to know which of those 2 to the 6 bytes we are looking at, we need 6 bits. So the bottom 6 bits are going to be our offset bits. And it happens that all the caches have 64 byte blocks. And that's pretty common if you think of connecting these caches to each other. It's really convenient if we're always reading and reading the same sizes in each of the caches to transfer values from one to the other. So very often you'll see processors built like this where all the caches will have the same block size. And so that means that we have 6 offset bits. So this is 6 offset bits. And we can tell that these are our least significant 6 bits because our offset bits are always the least significant ones. So we're a third done with one step. Questions on how I figured that out? Okay, so then we have to figure out our index and tag bits. And the tag bits are everything left over after we take into account index and offset. And probably we'll do the tag bits last. So what would be a good next step for figuring out the index? But let's start with the L1 data cache, yeah.
You can get the number of sets by taking the cache size, dividing it by the bytes. You can get the sets from
Okay, so you can say, I can get the sets from the last equation. Let's think about like what this means as far as the cache goes. So the last equation is saying that our cache size is our block size times the number of sets times the number of blocks per set. So what that's saying is that if I'm thinking of the data on my cache, if I have E blocks per set, so that's sort of the width of my cache, and I have S sets, and each of these blocks here is B bytes, the cache size I'm given is the total size of that whole rectangle. And I just want to figure out how many rows it has. So what can I think of they're doing there? Is, well, I want to know how much stuff is in each row. Well, how much stuff is in each row? That's E times B. So if I take the size divided by E times B, that's sort of the total size divided by the row size, equals number of rows, which is the same as the, in the formulas we have here, the total cache size, total amount of data, divided by the number of bytes per set per block times the number of, which is the same as S, which is cache size divided by bytes per block times blocks per set. So I'm just saying, here's the size of a row, you know, the total size, let's find the number of rows by doing some division. Some questions on how I figured that out? Formula works. So in the case of our first cache, we can have our byte size, but we're doing our formulas. We have this, again, this is figuring out, this is the row size over total size, and that's 32k divided by 64 bytes times 8. If you want to do this without calculators, remember, I told you 32 kilobytes was 32 times 2 to the 10, so we're always going to have kilobyte and megabyte represent a power of 2 when we're talking about caches. Well, remember I said everything in caches, like, we have to have powers of 2 in most places because we want to have the be able to divide things up into bits. So our cache size is always going to be based on powers of 2. They might not be a power of 2 because we can have like a three-way cache, three columns, but they're going to be based on powers of 2. So this is 32 times 2 to the 10, which is the same thing as 2 to the 15 over 64, which is 2 to the 6 times 8, which is 2 to the 3, or 2 to the 9, which gives us 2 to the 6, 15 minus 9. So that's a way you can do that without a calculator. So we got 64 sets, or 2 to the 6 sets, which means we have 6 index bits. We need 6 bits to figure out which of 2 to the 6 things, or if I'm numbering them in binary, I'm going to start with all zeros and end up with 6 ones. So questions on how I did that calculation? Okay. So we can do that calculation for all our caches. And we should get these numbers. And as far as actually dividing them, so I'm going to take the least significant bits, that's always our offset. And then I'm going to take the appropriate number of bits. So in the case of the L1, the next 6 bits are our index, everything else is the tag. I'm going to do the same thing for the L2 and L3 based on the number of sets we computed and therefore the number of index bits. Questions about these calculations? Okay, so next time we're going to fix up 2 issues we glossed over with our set associative caches. So one was replacement. So if we have our set is full and we want to bring something new into it, where do we put it? And another is writes. We haven't talked about what we do with writes. We talked about reading values from memory, but we have to write values, and we have to talk about, well, how is that going to work with our caches? And since someone asked about, like, is set associative better, I do have actual numbers from one example benchmark. So you can see this is sort of typically what happens, that adding associativity usually helps, but it's not guaranteed.